Welcome back to the Ignite podcast. Today, we're delighted to have Karthik Ramakrishnan on the program, founder of Armilla AI, a YC founder, extensive experience in the Canadian tech ecosystem. I'm also Canadian, and I'm really excited to talk to him about AI. Karthik, welcome to the program. Would love to get an intro from you for the audience.
Thanks for having me on, Brian. Currently, I'm the CEO and co-founder of Armilla AI, where we're building a platform to understand and quantify the risk of AI systems and models. And subsequently, we're starting to ensure the risk of these underlying risks in these AI models, which is a big and a hot topic in many different circles. Prior to that, I mean, origin story, if you will, moved to Canada as an immigrant, went to University of Waterloo, which is a hotbed for tech talent, as well as a lot of the successful startups that come out of Canada.
Is that Jeffrey Hinton, that's where he was a professor? Or
Dr. Hinton was a professor at the University of Toronto. And interestingly, and I was finishing up my master's, and back in, this is 20 years ago, but I was literally applying to his lab to do a PhD in neural networks. But what ended up happening was a startup that came out of some of the alums in the telecom space. I'd built my thesis was on, I was building a mesh network for technicality. Basically, you have, today, internet is all, there's a router, so you have nodes that actually, that are structured. Mesh networks is unstructured nodes that just come up, and then you can create a routing traffic. Anyways, did that. Ended up inadvertently building a software-based router. And so this telecom, it was started the mobile internet at that time. And telecom companies were struggling with, how do we police some traffic, policing the sense from a charge use standpoint? How do we do that? Most of the existing I'm going too deep into this, but most of the
it's interesting because it's like the internet good old days, right? 20 years ago when we had 2.5G and then 3G came out, and I was like, 3G. And
I totally
remember all that. Yeah.
This is before the G's, right?
So before the G's. Yeah.
And we had
OGs.
OGs, exactly. Cisco, Nortel, Siemens, Nokia, all these router providers were all hardware based, so they couldn't really handle the way the telecom operators wanted to, but because I'd done something programmable in Linux, ended up joining the startup to productize my master's thesis. I was like, that's more interesting than doing an academic PhD. Joined them, and within 6 months, Vodafone UK was our client for my product. And I was like, I had no idea how to be a product manager, but here I was, really explaining to them how this would work and designing this whole thing. But it was fantastic. So I was there with them for 7 years. Started as a software developer, but really became a product manager, and then evolved with the company as one does. You join a startup, I ended up moving to Germany as a sales engineer to help sell the product, which no one really understood it, and then moved to Dubai to set up the Middle East and Africa operations. I transitioned more into business development. And each one of these, so for me, like, that's when I got the startup kind of entrepreneur's bug, which is I enjoy this, which is building something from nothing. And after we went IPO, that was an opportunity to build my own sort of companies. And each one of my experiences in that company was 7 years. I was there, like, right from technical all the way to market development. I felt like I had all the skill sets to all the aspects of building a company. So my first startup was in the mobile advertising space.
I did mobile advertising at Rocket Fuel.
Yeah, and interesting.
So I built a lot of the location-powered products there. I built all kinds of really interesting things with all the lat-long coordinates. I think we had, billions of lat-long coordinates coming in every day from all the devices worldwide, and we could do a lot of interesting things with that.
Totally. And so the mobile advertising company I built was essentially to do more of that. So we actually started, it was typical, banner ads. Like, we built this custom interacting ad that could be integrated into apps and SDK, and then we would use the user data of what users are doing within the application to customize what we would show, right? And so did well. The exited to a gaming studio, was funded by IAC Media. One of the things we did, so Tinder came out of the same incubator as well. So
opportunity. That's your famous unicorn story. So tell you mine real quick. So when I came to SF, my first job, I wanted to work in solar, so I took a sales job at a solar company. It was a little solar startup in South Park. And like the epicenter of San Francisco tech is like South Park, and a bunch of VC firms and famous companies like Twitter. So we're in the old Twitter building, sharing an office with Instagram. So we get this rowdy bunch of solar startup guys, like 100 of us, and like the little hipster like 10 person company over here that sells for $1 billion. So that was like, yeah, that was my first exposure to San Francisco tech.
Not dissimilar. So here I was with my company, and you know, and there was Tinder, which wasn't Tinder at that time, right? Like it came out of the hackathon, and it was called Match Fuel at that time. Anyways, great story for them. But one of the things we started doing there was Facebook advertising had just started. And so they had me come in and sort of help them think through how to leverage Facebook APIs as they were coming out. And this is the pre-Cambridge Analytica days, right? It was a bit of the Wild West in terms of the data that you could access. So it was interesting. And then when Tinder took off, I thought, well, along those growth tactics could be very interesting for other companies to leverage, you know, Facebook Marketplace and Twitter as they were coming out. And so Gallup became a second company where there I got really into machine learning. And luckily, being in Toronto in 2012-13, that was the first breakthrough, right, that Jeffrey Hinton had and Ilya in creating the first working sort of neural networks there. And so it's like, okay, how can we leverage this machine learning?
How many nodes did it have?
I'm hard-pressed to say. Yeah.
Artificial neuron. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a trillion.
It wasn't very big. No, it was definitely tiny. I mean,
it was like hundreds, tiny. Maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Right? The number of layers, no, not that deep.
Yeah.
Right?
I think it was like four layers deep or something with like...
I was going to say that. It was like somewhere around five or...
I think it's about four or five layers. Yeah,
exactly. But it was groundbreaking, right? And so like, okay, here we are in Toronto. We should be leveraging this stuff. And so Gallup, we started using, well, we didn't use neural networks. It was still quite early. But we started, you know, using random forests and more of the machine learning, more rudimentary machine learning models, I would say. Yeah. But very effective, right? Regardless.
Yeah.
So
for very specific tasks like advertising, like that's all Rocket Fuel was using on 150 billion bid requests. It was just like a logistical regression model that was proprietary, obviously, but it was very detailed and you could do it 150 billion times a day.
Yeah. You know, they required
a ton of compute, even for a little logistical regression model.
Exactly, right? But, you know, again, we weren't using GPUs at the time, right? So maybe it might have been more efficient if they had been around at that time. But the little known kind of secret is most banks today depend on Loget, so logistical regression, and like, you know, random forests. Those models are still very effective for a lot of the use cases. So you're all kind of enamored by Gen AI, but those simple models work. You don't need to bring a machine gun to a gunfight, right? So anyways,
right tool for the right, right task, exactly. Right?
So
you don't need a nail gun to hang pictures on your wall. Yeah,
exactly. So we knew that, but it was effective. Like, so we would look into so we did behavior profiling. So we could go into a mobile app or a digital property and look at what users are doing and predict what they would do next, right? So who's engaging, who's monetizing. So really helping growth marketers understand their user behaviors and know where they're going. So you could say, well, this cohort about to sort of disengage and fall off the funnel. Let's run a different type of, you know, marketing or product improvements than this other group that is ready to monetize. So like what signals, we're getting those signals, what triggers would we send. So a lot of profiling, exited back to another gaming studio, ended up Deloitte for a brief while. Part of the company went to Deloitte, and I went with them to set up there. So this is the seminal days of AI, right? 2015, 16, and everyone was interested. And so I had them think through how their analytics practice would evolve into sort of an AI practice, if you will. Also helped them think through startups. So I ran a couple of startup ideas for them and built that out. But the folks at Element AI came knocking in. So Element.
Oh, I remember Element, yeah.
Yeah. So Element was started by Dr. Yosha Bengio. He's, of course, Dr. Hinton and Jan LeCun are famous, like in the public sphere, than Dr. Bengio, but he's a third person, like, you know, in all the developments of AI. And that was a wild ride. So 4 years, 16, 17, I spent a lot of my time educating enterprises on how they could leverage AI and what this could be, and started implementing sort of the first solution. So we ended up working with companies like Toyota and HSBC. And in those first few applications, it wasn't ultimately they were sold on the benefits. But until today, that problem child still exists, which is, what's the risk of these models? And it's not a matter of if, but when they're going to get something wrong. And then how big is that wrongness going to be and how is it going to impact them? So when Element got acquired by ServiceNow, I started Armilla with my co-founder Dan, because we've seen similar problems. Okay, how do we create trust in models? And everyone likes to say the word responsible AI or terms responsible AI, accountability, transparency, trust, all of that stuff.
Yeah, explainability is what we at Rocket Fuel, what we worked on a lot.
Right.
Is, you know, we have the agency customers and it's selling pizzas at 10x better than any other bake-off we did against any other direct response model in the industry. And they're like, well, why?
Exactly.
What can you teach us
right.
about why it's selling pizzas better than anybody else?
Exactly. And that's one dimension of trust, right? Like knowing why the model's going to make a decision. But what we thought of it from an engineering standpoint, being engineers, are like, okay, how do we bring all the good things we know about software development and testing and rigorous stress testing, integration, all of this testing that we do to understand a model, how do you bring that to the world of machine learning? And so we built that's why we started Armilla, to like really trust through evidence. So we could test a model, but also layer on, like at a technical level, but also layer on the business context, right? So the domain use case, to then translate when something goes wrong, what's the business impact of that? Like not every issue is an issue. It's an issue if it materially impacts your business and your customers and your stakeholders, right? So really understanding that and quantifying web risk. So we that's where we started, but as all good startups do, I suppose, we pivoted. And so what we realized—
In the program? NYC or—
No, actually post-YC. So we did YC, but it was the principles in YC that sort of you're exposed to, right? Like, how do you think about product market fit? How do you actually nail that down? And how do you know if something's not working? Right? Like, don't fall in love.
How do they teach you to, I'd love to like drill into those before we move on and to discuss the pivot. Like, how does YC define those things?
Well, it's, again, evidence-based, right? So you have an original thesis. Don't fall in love with the idea, fall in love with the problem, right? And that's what I learned previously, but YC really kind of put a structure around it, right? So, you know, how do you talk to customers? How do you understand, you know, pre-sell? If someone isn't willing to, even before you have a product, isn't willing to tell you that this is something that's useful and they're willing to put some money behind it, you really don't have a product, right? And money or resources or whatever effort that it takes, those friction points.
I will sign up right now for $1,000 a month to be your design partner on this. I need it so bad.
There you go, right? Yeah. And I think those principles and tactics, but really how do you, again, quantify that, right? Being statistician engineer, resonated with that a lot, right? But then also the marketing side, right? You know, how you go to market these days is very different from, you know, how we went to market 10 years ago or 20 years ago, right? Yeah. And so that was fantastic, because then we started really listening to our customers. Like, we fell in love with the idea, unfortunately, I think, in the beginning, where, hey, if you do really good testing of models, people should want this. Why wouldn't they, right?
Oh, my gosh. I fell prey to this so many times in my product career. Like, we built so many things at Rocket Fuel. Like probably half the stuff I built at Rocket Fuel over a 3-year period. This is like an ad tech unicorn with 30 PhDs on staff, 250 person engineering team. We could build whatever we wanted, right?
Yeah. Like,
I'd build the stupidest stuff that nobody paid for, and I just got beat over my head so many times with failure. I just really, really learned kind of the intricacies of really understanding what people actually buy at scale versus what is just kind of like a, like you said, like a really nice engineering project.
Exactly. Right. And it's easy, right? It's easy to fall in love with the idea because it's your idea, it's your baby. And then you're like, well, someone must want this. I just need to find the person who wants this.
This is such a good idea.
Yeah, exactly. Right. and there was actually a book that, you know, one of my YC cohort mates took me on to. It's called The Mom Test, right? If you're, you know, your mom's always going to tell you, regardless of what you say, she's like, I love it. Because, you know, the mom, how is she going to tell you that, you know, that's a stupid idea, right? Like, you know, they're going to love you regardless. But, and those are, I mean, that's the sort of the bubble you fall into. You talk to people who love the idea or love the idea, right? Are they putting money behind it? No, right? So you talk to people who are more cynical, right, and come from, and I don't mean cynicism in a negative way, but really in a healthy way, that helps you sharpen what you're solving for, right? So that was it. We started listening to customers and really listening to customers. And what we discovered was no matter how much you quantify the risk of models and help them test and put, you know, all these nice identification of risk mitigations, et cetera, ultimately, even if after you've done everything really well, the risk still exists in some small, it's not never non-zero risk in anything.
Right.
And so as an enterprise, they said, well, typically, you know, when these things happen, you know, your platform can tell us what the risk is. As a risk manager, the risk still exists. What should I do? And that's when we started thinking about, you know, risk transfer. And so risk transfer is what, that's where insurance, you know, more broadly, right, steps in as a means to de-risk or protect yourself from these residual risks, right, that exist in the system. And as I started looking at it further, I mean, we can get philosophical about insurance, but it's one of the oldest industries out there.
Yeah. So my partner, my wife, worked in reinsurance and insurance tech before we moved to the Bay. So I'm pretty familiar with the space.
Right. And so, I started reading it again, being an engineer, like, whoa, what is this thing? You're looking at Mesopotamia times, the Hammurabi, like, tablets that actually talk about insurance. It was ridiculous, right?
Thousands and thousands of years old.
Millennia, right? And so, and I said, okay, fine. Like, we didn't know much about insurance, so that's when we started educating ourselves. And then we then built what we're now building, Pivot, or get to that end, is we are now building some of the first risk transfer products for AI. We've taken what we built as a platform and now starting to underwrite the risk of models.
Interesting. And so what that protects is, I'm a bank or a financial institution, or I got money on the line, right? I got money riding on this AI system that I'm implementing, and there's some risk here. And in order to get more comfortable with the risk, because there's some false positives or some false negatives, and those are costly. And there's a certain statistical probability that happens at scale. Like you said, there's non-zero chance of this, you know, AI failing or being wrong. And we can quantify that somehow and insure you against it.
Precisely, right? And not every risk is insurable, of course, right? Yeah. I mean, but under the right considerations and right underwriting processes, we can determine if that risk is insurable and then, help predict that downside risk.
Insurance for AI. Yeah, this is a concept I've never actually heard of, and I'm fascinated. So, let's take a historical analogy, because I think people think in analogies when they learn new things. When's the last time a new insurance product rolled out? There's a new way of doing things and we need a new kind of insurance for it, you know?
Yeah.
Probably automobiles, maybe, like, for sure automobiles, right? When automobiles came out, it's like, people are hitting people and killing people and smashing up buildings and roadway signs, and we need to insure that. But, like, is there a technological, I guess that's a technological advancement. Could you think of anything else?
Oh, yeah. I mean, more recently, in the last 15 years, cyber insurance is the most recent, right? The cyber came as a function of everything moving to the cloud. Now, cyber insurance started 20 years ago. The first policy was in 1999. But it was actually under property damage. So if your property, I don't know how they defined it. I didn't look that deeply into the first policy. But, you know, over the last 10 years, as, you know, cloud came in and we were pushing more things to the cloud, we had regulations on GDPR, privacy, and then the hackability of these systems started becoming more apparent that you're now needing a protection. So, like, you could put all your cybersecurity measures in place. You can get your software compliance, your firewalls, your lockdown systems, 2FA, right? But there is a non-zero chance that you can still get hacked, right? And so, or something else happening. So cyber insurance.
How big is that industry now? Do you know?
$15 billion.
$15 billion a year.
$15 billion a year.
Cyber insurance.
In less than 10 years. And they've barely scratched the surface. The actual market size is somewhere around $5 billion. Surprisingly, as much as, you know, we're all aware of cyber issues, very few people actually buy it. I wouldn't say very few. I would say not as many people are buying it as they should be.
Well, right? It's just like getting in a car accident and you only had liability and you're like, gosh, I should have had comprehensive.
Exactly.
And then going forward, you always buy comprehensive. Or you're like an organization for some Fortune 500 company, and you're like, I don't think that's an issue. We'll just kind of live with that on our balance sheet. And then something happens and it costs tens of millions of dollars. And the CFO is like, how do we protect ourselves, you know, against this in the future?
Exactly.
It, like anything else in humanity or the human species, we're kind of like reactive and we become risk seeking in the domain of losses is behavioral econ terminology for it.
Right.
And so, yeah, in this case, it's kind of like, ooh, I'm afraid of this loss. I felt the pain of that loss and now I need to insure against it in the future.
Right. Now, in the AI risk, we haven't yet felt that pain in a very large way, right? So the pain is still emerging. We know it's there. Yeah. It's a matter of when that sort of tidal wave of pain emerges. Yeah.
Well, this goes back into the there's no bad ideas, just bad timing. How do you know? How do you know you're not too early to this market? Because it could be, you know, cybersecurity 95 for AI, right?
Yeah, you know,
2005.
That's that, and that is the I would guess a few billion dollar question, right? And I'm very much a victim of this, where you know some of my the things that I've done have been too far ahead, right? Like what we did 10 years ago at Gallup Labs, predicting user behaviors today would be an AI company, right? And a lot of ideas around AI are on next best action platforms, right? Can use AI on Salesforce, like Einstein on Salesforce CRM does that, right? Can we try to predict who in your funnel is something that you should spend time on versus somebody else, right? Like, so these things are, I mean, they're now almost commonplace. 10 years ago, it was quite interesting to bring with AI. And one of the challenges we had was telling our customers, explaining to our customers how this worked, and trust was an issue, right? Like, how do I trust that your funnel development here and predictions are accurate? And we say, well, I don't know until you start putting it in, but it'll be more right than wrong. You catch more things. All of that to say, we were ahead of we were a bit early, I think, from that standpoint in using kind of machine learning. And my co-founder had the same problem as well, right? Like, he built a company around, you know, in AML, KYC, using machine learning and AI. And the first 5 years was spent educating the market. I mean, ultimately, they were very successful, deployed across hundreds of banks today. But when he exited, but first 2 years was hard slog. So to your question about, are we early? I think this is, I think, again, we're falling in love with the problem and not the idea, right? So the problem exists.
Yeah.
And if it's a timing issue, then we have to structure ourselves in a way to bide that time. Right. And what do we need to do in place to get that? I say, but my bet, of course, we're betting on this, that you're not too far off from a timing standpoint.
Right. Well, and there's already AI systems making trillions and trillions of decisions every day. And so you call that the seminal period of AI earlier. So I bet if you go back and look at AI that was deployed 5 to 10 years ago with kind of the state-of-the-art models at the time, making a lot of these decisions. I mean, you said yourself, like a lot of the banks are still using a lot of these logistical regressions, random forest, stuff like that. I mean, maybe you could start there. Maybe the Gen AI stuff might be too early, right? Because it hasn't been fully adopted and implemented everywhere. But then I think, how do you think about that problem size, that friction size of how do you quantify that problem size for institutions?
Insurance is a backward-looking industry. And I mean that negatively. I mean, you're not forward-looking.
Yeah, you get the actuarial tables of risk. Yeah,
exactly. Right. So we do have that challenge today, right? In terms of when do we have data and where we don't. And so we're going into spaces where we have data, right, compared to anyone else. Again, having been in the industry, the advantage of having been in the AI, quote unquote, AI industry for the last 10 years with me and co-founder, we have a lot of institution knowledge, but also data that we have built over time. And so that has helped us inform what we can cover and what we can insure. And yes, the more...
So you guys already have, you're already selling these insurance products to organizations?
Yeah. So as of last fall, launching an insurance product is not easy. It takes years.
Especially for something complex and new like this. This isn't like your next SaaS product that, you know, does some whiz-bangery kind of sassy thing.
Yeah.
This is like at the marriage of like AI, risk, and insure tech. So I think it's a much more complex thing to launch.
Exactly.
Tell us the story, like your first customer, without giving away too much, like why they bought it, how they quantified it, what made sense, what were they detecting, what was the business cost of not doing it, things like that?
Excellent question. In fact, and we publicly talked about it, so I can mention their name as well.
Okay, good. Otherwise, we'd have to bleep this out, but yeah, okay.
so two of them, take the example. So private AI, Buddy AI. So we the two of our early customers, and there's others, which I cannot talk about, but the problem for them, like with any AI company today, your biggest challenge is establishing credibility with your client, right? That your model actually works. A, it does what it's supposed to do, and that you have, you know, everything in place to lock down where it doesn't work, right? And again, having built these products in the past, you kind of know that challenge and how you overcome. Of course, you're going to overcome it while doing your POCs, you know, especially if you're going to an enterprise, these sales cycles are very long. So their challenge was, you know, at least for one of them in the healthcare space, their cycles were like 12 months long in terms of sales. And the reason we came up with this is because we faced this challenge before. So how do we reduce sales cycles? How do we create trust more quickly than not? You're not in the enterprise. I don't think you'll ever get away from not doing a POC entirely. But the rigor and the number of times you're going to do a POC with different groups in the organization, from your product group to your business group to your IT group to the risk and compliance and procurement, you can reduce that. And so what we do is think of us like Matter for AI. So we go in and do a SOC 2 compliance like report on the model, right? So independent, third-party tested, and really establish whether the model does what it's supposed to do. So if you're saying my model is 95% accurate, it's unbiased, these are the failure modes, et cetera, we would verify all that through our own testing, and then we produce a certification, right? So Armilla verified, and then what we do is provide a guarantee on the performance of that model. Mm. So that is where we take the financial risk, right, of the model not performing. So now what you've told your customer as private AI or Buddy is, look, we've opened up the AI systems to an independent third party, it's verified, it's audited, and they believe it. And not only that, they're willing to back it with financial guarantee. Well, I wouldn't say financial guarantee, but certainly a guarantee.
We've insured it.
You know, thank you.
Yeah.
Right. And so we can say, and the first product we have is a product guarantee, which basically covers up to the cost of the product. So if an enterprise spends $500,000 or $1 million on the product, we will reimburse them that amount should the model fail. Right. So now what we've done is taken away the buying risk for the enterprise, and taking away the performance risk, which is something that they're all worried about in the AI model. And for the startup, you know, we've given them a competitive differentiation, right? Comparative competitor. If you have this validation and this guarantee, you could sell better. And that's what our clients are seeing now.
So the SaaS company selling to the customer is actually the one paying for the insurance. They're saying, hey, we're going to charge you $1 million a year to use this model, I'm just whatever.
Okay.
And we've certified and insured this with our Armilla for 5 or 10% of the model cost or whatever it is yearly to kind of whatever that percentage is.
Okay.
And then if it fails to operate properly, you can cash in on that insurance policy.
I wouldn't use the word cash in because that feels like an insurance.
Be covered. Risk will be covered. Yeah. Yeah, that's a very interesting model. How do you handle the model drift that happens, right? Because you have to retrain the model with data that's coming in, and you probably have at least monthly releases, if not weekly, or some people are doing a build every day. How do you handle kind of the model drift that can happen over time and recertification, reinsurance?
Good question.
Not reinsurance in the term of like reinsuring something, but like,
totally
verifying that you're still going to back it. Yeah,
exactly. That, you know, can be an operational challenge if it's really complex. But in the most simplest forms, if there's a significant model update, so through our verification, we have a baseline of what the model does and how it does it. And if there's a significant change, so one is operational drift. So when the model is operating, it drifts from what it was designed for. And so what we encourage is having MLOps systems in place, and we have partnerships with those companies. So they tell us, we've identified bands outside of which if they veer too far off the kind of the standard operating band, then we should be notified, right? And it's up to the company to rectify. So that's operational drift. That one as an operator of an AI model, should be on top of it, right? And so we look at those processes, the technologies we're using, and we have partners who we bring to the table to make sure those copies are monitoring appropriately. On the other side, which is more intentional, right, which is I retrained the model, there's a new version of it, has new features that it may or may not trigger depending on how big the delta is. It may or may not re-trigger another assessment. And those are pretty quick because we've done the first assessment. The second one's pretty...
Well, yeah, you have a bunch of inputs. A model fundamentally is this black box that full of algorithms that has a bunch of inputs and gives you a certain predictable set of outputs measured against some, utility function. And there's lots of different ways, like F-scores and stuff like that, to measure the efficacy of a model. And so I'm sure, like, you've basically run all these tests on the inputs and outputs. And then when the model gets retrained or modified, you basically just run like a regression test, basically. You just run the same test that you already ran. And then you're like, it actually drifted too far. And now it's gonna double your cost of insurance. Like, has that happened yet? Where like, oh, yeah, you guys changed this model. Yeah, it has a better, like, area above the curve or whatever. But you're actually riskier in this way now.
Yes, I mean, it has happened with the client, but not in the sense that they've not been able to continue to guarantee the performance. In the way that it has changed, we were able to detect it, and I mean, well enough that even though they retrained it, it was still quite a good model, and it still did what it's supposed to do, and so we were able to continue guaranteeing it.
Yeah.
Right? So, so that's how we're thinking about it. Now, on the other hand, we're also seeing enterprises now coming to us and saying, can you test these models for us and provide a warranty as part of the procurement process, right? That's
a new
concept.
Another form of insurance. Yeah,
exactly. Right, but
rather than the risk of loss, it's like the risk of poor performance.
Precisely, and that's what we're really worried about in the AI right now: right? Performance. The business sort of risks will come in, but as we deploy these models and we look at errors that we cause business risk, we'll understand them better. I'm sure there'll be other insurance products to come out with that. But right now, it's performance risk that's top of mind.
Yeah, I love that. And, back to, the Babylonian, tablets, right? Like, first comes commerce, right? First comes production, second comes commerce, third comes insurance. maybe that's where we're at with AI, where it's kind of like, okay, now these things are really conducting a lot of the commerce, and we need warranties and guarantees against poor performance. In any insurance transaction, there's typically, somebody who's ultimately taking on the risk. So who's ultimately taking on the risk here? It's not you guys, I assume. You're selling this financial product to somebody as like a reinsurer or some financial institution or some group of investors that really knows insurance and really likes investing in insurance products. So, like, tell us, like, you got your customer, right? But then you got somebody, you got a financial backer somehow over here.
Yeah, we do. Tell us about that. In fact, it's the balance sheet risk, essentially, right? Of running that. We're partnered with Swiss Re, and we're lucky that Swiss Re, one of the largest reinsurers, or if not the largest.
I think it might be the largest, yeah.
Reinsurer has come on board to back us. And alongside then, we have our primary insurers are actually the Lloyd's syndicates, Greenlight Re and Chaucer. And so they are the primary insurers. And then behind them is Swiss Re as a reinsurer. But we have a panel across all three of them.
You're the underwriter here, and you're like making this financial product. And then they're ultimately, buying that product for some, percentage of the for the fee. And that's the transaction. So you're basically originating it and brokering it off to them, getting it off your balance sheet.
Right.
And so ultimately, they're taking on the risk for that model.
Precisely. One of the biggest challenges is helping them understand how we do the underwriting and all that. So because we started a year ago on this path, it took us a while to get here, but, they're very comfortable now to give us the underwriting 10.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So what's next? What's the vision for this in the next, 5 to 10 years? And kind of what are you excited about?
Look, I mean, I'm really excited about, if I take a step back, right? Ultimately, we aren't insurers. We are AI folks, right, in the company. And this may seem a little apple pie.
Elitist.
Right? Not even elitist, but, grandiose. But
we're not insurance people. We're AI people.
But what we really care about fundamentally is AI as something seminal to our world, right? And transformative. And what you're seeing is, from our experiences, risk being one of the biggest blockers for AI adoption, absolutely in the enterprise. If we can help accelerate the adoption of AI by being able to play our card in terms of underwriting that risk, then I think we will accelerate the adoption of AI, which is what I really care about.
You know, I launched SageMaker Marketplace, which is a marketplace for algorithms and models, which is basically an e-commerce store for machine learning and AI. And, it has like 1,000 maybe now of models and algorithms. And I'm picturing kind of like in the future, it's pretty early for this, but maybe 5-10 years in the future, there's you guys are in the store with like a little badge. You know, we've certified this. You know, kind of what was the retailer one? Was it Square?
Yeah, the Square. You have the JD Power, signs like already there, right? Like, but in the technology world, you have this up-to compliance and the badges that you put on, and it may not be as far as you think. Like, in that journey. So yeah, I mean that would be fantastic, right? Where you could put in a certification, right, that is accepted, and every company needs to have that certification in place to keep to the world about what they're doing.
Yeah.
But really, in the long term, I think this is pretty exciting, because the other thing I would say is I expect generative AI to be eclipsed by something else in the next 2 years. That's my basic expectation, right? And so once that looks like, right? And so this risk is going to be constantly evolving technically, because the technology is constantly
right. evolving. Yeah. And this is an interesting point that you're making, which is, most things are kind of, slow moving, right? In the physical world, like automobile safety systems, they take decades to kind of roll out. Like seatbelts were a big innovation, right? And then airbags, side curtain airbags, crumple zones, yada yada, the list goes on. But those kind of roll out slow, and insurance companies can kind of adjust, because it's like, okay, this is coming. It's, the government reviewed it, it's crash tests and blah blah blah, we can get data on it. AI is so fast moving, right? Just the large language models alone get 5 to 10x more complex every year right now. So how do you continuously underwrite risk for something that changes in such a dynamic way, and maybe might be like changing faster and faster, right?
And that's why we are AI folks first and foremost, because that's when we spend a lot of our time, right? Looking at, and we had our ability to test generative AI models like a year ago, right? So, by the time OpenAI had launched, we are on top of the, when the technology is moving and keeping on top of that. And to me, that will be success for our mission. We can help organizations understand and put their arms around the risk of these models, wherever they may come from, and as they evolve, then I think we would have that's a job well done for us, right? Fundamentally. And so I think keeping on top of this risk is going to be the biggest challenge for the industry. And I think we're well positioned to do that. So that's what I'm excited about.
Yeah, that's amazing. So why don't we switch to a rapid fire to sort of wrap it up?
Sure. Right.
Kind of in the same vein, what's one technology trend you're excited about?
I'm just excited about autonomous vehicles, to be honest. I've got my little taste of that with the self-driving, as limited as it is on the Tesla.
Well, self-driving, exactly. I'm doing air quotes. Yeah.
There you go. FSD. But it's magical and it works. And
it
so,
is really magic, yeah.
So that's, to me, that we don't think about it, how much time we spend driving and what we do and commuting, and if that can be made painless and more effective, that's one thing I'm really looking forward to.
If you could solve one global problem with AI, what would it be?
Education. And I think that education is seminal to everything else that comes afterwards. Every other problem can be solved once everyone's educated about it. And education, I think, there's different modalities, and I have a 10-year-old, and as I'm seeing him learn and grow, like he learns very differently from the way I learn, right? But that's he's privileged, to live in in sort of the Western hemisphere and have access to all of the things that we have access to here. But in the villages, right? And I think of that, I'm originally from India, and I see how education needs to get disseminated to the far reaches. The internet is going to enable that, but now when we have AI on top of that, once education reaches them, everyone benefits in that society. And then we can solve the bigger problems. Every other problem can be solved if everyone's educated and gets to that level of awareness to solve problems.
You know, what's interesting about that, you know, Andreessen said software is eating the world. Then software kind of ate education.
Is it?
Now AI is kind of eating the rest of the world, and AI, I think, will also eat education. And you can just imagine, like, you know, even the free models, you know, from you know, OpenAI and Anthropic and Google are pretty freaking good tutors, right? So kids now can go talk to an AI and get help in anything, and you know, and with the best models, and soon to be free in the next year or two, probably, you know, take pictures of their math problems or their science problems and can explain this to me. I don't understand this, and so you can get individualized, customized help and tutorship. Tutorship at scale. Every all 8 billion of us, and that's just like. We've never lived in a world like that where you can get some of the best help. And, you know, in a lot of these AI tests, you know, the models outperform most humans at the college level. And they're at the median at the graduate school level. So they're already as good as like kind of the average graduate student at explaining things and understanding things in most domains. And so, like, it's just a different world that our kids are going to grow up. Because I also have, you know, three kids around the same age. And I just see like the way they approach solving things is just way different from how we did it.
Yeah, and they're not afraid to call me out when I'm wrong. It's like, that's wrong, and that's why. And they're like, I didn't even realize you could think about a problem that way. But if I take that a step further, yes, personalized education, the learning styles, all of that is great. You know, where it becomes even more interesting is when the languages. Right. Like, so if you go to the far reaches of a non-English speaking environment, AI can make that translation. It could take an MIT course, translate that into a language that's understandable and more absorbable by those different communities. I think about that. Right. I think that's going to be excellent as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I mean, that's unlocking for everyone. Right.
Right.
Anybody with a. Even some of the poorest people in the world have smartphones connected to the internet, and now they're going to have all of human knowledge unlocked, and translated and guided, and self-guided. And I think we'll see a huge explosion of human creativity in the next, you know, 5 or 10 years, 20 years, especially because of that, right? Cause now kids growing up, they can find exactly what they're most interested in. And maybe it's making podcasts and YouTube videos, but maybe it's, you know, studying new laws of physics or new engineering paradigms. They, you know, some kid in sub-Saharan Africa can just be on the Android device and figure that stuff out and emerge with a Nobel Prize someday. I mean, that's really exciting stuff because we're unlocking human potential.
Exactly.
And it's not just the hundreds of millions or a billion or so people in, call it the developed economies in the world. So yeah, pretty freaking exciting time to be alive. What's your favorite book on business or technology?
I'm hard pressed to say because there's a number, but I literally just stick with the new one that I'm reading right now, which is Ray Dalio's book on the principles, right?
And I think the principles. Yeah.
It's. I think I'm taking away so much with every chapter, and just you know, I think that's a fantastic book. I think it should be on everyone's reading list.
What are some of your favorite principles off the top of your head from that book?
You know, right now, so my interpretation of that, so let me put it that way, is, I mean, because it's a reinforcing thing, because like I believe in that. So when you're talking about teams and you know, there's a whole management style of like, you know, being very, very micromanaging about things, right? And that's a big problem. And to me, it's always been, you get the best people, right? And you give them full autonomy to do what they need to do. But then how do you cohesively make them all, you know, interact and work with each other? And I think that's one of the principles there about, you know, teamwork, right? It's a Navy SEALs attitude. Like nothing gets individually, no one is as strong as a team. So that's number one. And second, how do you balance between autonomy and that teamwork, right? And I think that if you get that formula right, then, you know, get rid of things like politics in the organization, get rid of the things you try to do happen as you grow. And so that was my big takeaway from, it was not just one principle, it was a few of these principles to put together.
Yeah.
That to me was a big, you know, reinforcement, but also a structured way of thinking about it.
Yeah, a little plug for Transcendental Meditation. Ray Dalio is a longtime meditator of TM, and I had his teacher on the program, actually, on the podcast, Mario Mazzetti. He encourages everyone at Bridgewater to study TM. So everyone out there, go study TM. Ray Dalio, he's a billionaire with a big hedge fund, and all those guys are doing it. You should check it out.
Yeah.
Who's your biggest inspiration in the tech industry?
Okay, I'm going to sound very right out of the middle when I say this, but certainly Steve Jobs, right? I think categorically, though, you know, there's many things I appreciate about him. Like, I mean, let's set aside some of the personality issues that, you know, everyone complains about, but really for him...
Do more deodorant because he was eating fruit.
Right. But, you know, or it is, you know, how... all the things, I didn't even dwell on that, but what I will dwell on is he had this uncanny ability to link things, like, you know, disparate things together. But more than that, his ability to articulate what he wanted to get done and how, right? And so there's these videos that every time I see him, like just explaining what someone was telling him about the marketing aspect of and what Apple is, right, and what it translates to, and how you thought about how the market was treating Apple, right, when he came back into the organization, and explain that to a room full of 1,000+ Apple employees who have their own cynicism about things, or they've just come up from a very difficult time, but then being able to bring them all coalesce under that vision, so articulation, but also the business mind, right? He's a very technical guy, but ultimately, again, he didn't fall in love with the ideas, he fell in love with the problems. Right. And so I think he's a manifestation of, for me, of that. I mean, look, he got other things wrong too, but I would say he got more, the things he got right, he got them right really well. And I think that to me, I really admire also this tenacity of being those things. Yeah. Right.
What was the last video game you played?
Oh, unfortunately, I don't have much time for video games these days. Can I just say Mario Brothers? Because I played that.
That's
with
the
my,
last one you played?
Yeah.
Played with your kids?
With my kids, yeah. So, you know, okay. We got a Switch, so, you know, play that quite a bit with them, plus with the movie coming out and everything. Anyways, that most of my video game playing was with my son, so, yeah.
Yeah. All right, last question. What's one piece of advice you'd give an aspiring entrepreneur?
Oh, just repeat what I said before. Fall in love with the problem, not the idea. It's easy to do that, but once, you know, and the problem may not be what you think it is, and will... It may not be the same for everyone. It manifests itself differently. So, as we're running a product, really understanding that like problem set is going to be that's what makes or breaks a company.
Yeah. Well, this was amazing, Karthik. This is for the audience, this is the first time Karthik and I have actually met. You know, we kind of got introduced, and I was like, yeah, let's definitely have him on the pod. So, yeah, it went really well. Thank you for coming on, and really appreciate it.
Thanks, Brad. Appreciate it too.